don't know if you heard this story, but it's a story out of California where there's an infertility clinic. What they're doing is they have a policy of performing the in vitro fertilization, the artificial insemination, only for married women. Well, a lesbian couple came by. They wanted the same services. They refused, and now they're suing. Do lesbian couples have a right to have a baby? Does anyone and everyone have a right to have a baby, to adopt, to do whatever they want when it comes to children? We're going to talk about that in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Jennifer Roback Morse is going to join us. She wrote about both that case and why no one has a right to have a child. We'll be talking about that here in the first 25 minutes. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, discussing the right to have a child in the first half hour. And then Susan Muscat joins us. We'll be talking to her about pro-life legislation. Yesterday we did both Missouri and Illinois. Today we look at the national scene in an election year 2006. What lies ahead by way of pro-life legislation that we should know about? And then Dr. James Lamb will be our guest in the second hour of the program. The circumcision of Jesus and life issues. The two go together. And of course, the church just celebrated this last Sunday, both the naming and the circumcision of our Savior Jesus Christ. Dr. James Lamb from National Lutherans for Life. Then Dr. Thomas Madden, you might have seen this ABC primetime news special over the holidays. Pope Joan, female pope, a woman parading as a man, 2 years served as pope. Is it true? It was on TV. It must be. Well, Dr. Thomas Madden says, wait a minute, and we'll talk with him about that coming up later in the program. Then, because it is close to the beginning of the Epiphany season, we're talking about tomorrow, Epiphany Day. We'll discuss Epiphany here with Dr. Richard Stuckwish. And finally on the program, Bob Leko joins us for the last half hour of the program to talk about the curses made by charismatic extremists. Yes, curses. We'll talk about that last here on Issues, Etc. Jennifer Roback Morse is a regular guest. She is a research fellow for the Hoover Institute, author of the book Smart Sex: Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World, and she's also written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled First Comes Marriage. Jennifer, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Todd.
All right, fill us in on the story out of Vista, California, about this lesbian couple suing for a baby.
Well, what happened was back in 1999, this couple went to an infertility clinic in Vista and wanted to be artificially inseminated, and the doctors, you know, proceeded along and did their intake and so on, and then discovered that the couple was not married and, in fact, was a lesbian couple. And on that basis, they decided not to go forward with the insemination, and they mentioned said that they had a policy of only doing artificial insemination for married couples. Well, now, you know, years later, this couple is turning around and suing this clinic for discrimination by sexual orientation. And in the meantime, the couple went to they went to another clinic. They've had a baby. They are expecting their second baby. And so it's not as if they didn't get their child. They did ultimately get to have two children, but they are trying to sue the doctor. And the doctors are trying to claim religious conscience, that their policy of only inseminating married couples is based on religious belief, and that they're therefore entitled to do to do that, and that they're entitled to use that discretion in their practice. So those are that's the issue in that particular case.
Well, you know, we live in especially when it comes to our politics, a culture of rights with very few responsibilities, Jennifer. Those rights are asserted sometimes without any real legal or constitutional merit, but there are many who would say, well, that seems to make sense. If someone wants to have a child and is fit to raise a child, how could they be denied that right, even if it is through an infertility clinic?
Well, I mean, the issue is this. Does anybody really, in fact, have a right to have a child? And when you start to think about that, our language of rights doesn't really get us very far in thinking in those terms because of the following reason. The language of rights is typically a language for individuals, that's used for individuals. And the fact is that having a baby is not an individual project, as much as we might think that it is, and as much as we've tried to turn it into an individual project. the fact is that every child, every human child, has both a mother and a father. And what we've really done is to somehow cut the second party, the second parent, out of that loop in order to turn it into an individual project. And so if there's going to be a right to have a child, it's a right that needs to reside in the couple and not in an individual, because really what you're saying, if you say an individual has a right to have a child, you're saying that they have a right to the genetic material from another person without any kind of connection to that person, that somehow that's a legal entitlement. And I just think that's a path we really don't want to go down. If we think it through very far, we really don't want to go down that path.
And we do tread lightly here, I think, because we would not say that because no fundamental right exists for any one individual, to have a child, that the state would thereby correct in curtailing the rights of ordinary married couples to have children, saying, oh, no, one child is enough, like they do in China or something.
Right. Well, you see, I mean, I think the most sensible way to look at it, the way that's the most grounded in biological reality as well as social reality, is to say, look, the right to have a child inheres in a couple. And what kind of couple? A couple that is committed to one another and committed to having a common life together that's substantial enough to raise the child to maturity. That kind of commitment says that, I mean, if we have that kind of social position that says that's who has a right to a child, that's inherent, that recognizes the inherent natural right that any couple has to make a baby. I mean, the fact is, the biggest social problem in most societies is to stop people from making babies, because it's so easy to do and it's so natural to do, right? So what societies have always had to do and tried to do is to channel the procreative urge and the sexual urge into channels that are socially responsible, so that you have couples who will be with each other and with the child long enough to raise the child to maturity. And, of course, the institution that does that is marriage. And whether it's polygamous marriage in a Islamic country or lifelong monogamy in a Christian country, the institution of marriage is designed to fulfill exactly that purpose, to create an institution that binds couples to each other and to their child. And then you can park all kinds of rights in there on that couple, because they are the natural unit that brings forth the baby. The state doesn't give babies to people, you know. The state doesn't deliver babies, and the state doesn't give entitlements to babies. The fact is that once you've created the marriage and said this counts as a marriage and maybe something else doesn't count as a marriage, but this is a marriage, the right to procreate is inherent and is truly natural in the marriage relationship. And that, I think, is the fundamental point that we've lost sight of, because we've been so seduced, really, by our fancy reproductive technology that allows it to appear as if procreation is an individual right and an individual project. We've lost sight of the fact that there's inherently and biologically and socially a coupling involved in bringing forth a baby, and that somehow we need to protect and sustain that coupling.
It wasn't that long ago, Jennifer, that a woman who said, well, I want to have a baby, would have naturally thought, well, that means finding a nice boy and marrying him.
That's right.
And for a woman to have said, maybe 100 years ago, not so long ago, for a woman to have said, I want to have a baby, and then said, but the whole meeting the boy and getting married, that sort of stuff, that's not for me. I just want to have the baby. That
right.
would have been considered on the edge of obscenity.
Right, right. And you know, there are so many good reasons for that. I mean, now we've kind of, well, I want to just point out something that I said in the Touchstone article. You mentioned this Touchstone article. I want to just point something out, because I think most people don't know that this, and I didn't know it until I did the research for the article. And that is that in order for women to have an anonymous sperm donor pregnancy, you have to think about what's involved in that. You see, there are many babies that are born today through anonymous sperm donors. Okay, that's the case where a woman is saying, I want no relationship with my child's father. I completely want this baby to be my personal project. Well, you have to think about what makes that possible. See, in the ordinary course of natural living of a life, it's not possible to do that. You know, you have to have sex to have a baby. And what we've done is to create a set of legal institutions that make it possible for mothers and fathers to be complete strangers to one another. And the way it works is this. The law says that the sperm donor father is legally a stranger to the child. so that if a woman makes a withdrawal from a sperm bank and gets herself artificially inseminated, she can't turn around 10 years later and say, gee, I'm short of cash, I want to sue this guy for child support. She can't do that. The law cuts that out. At the same time, that sperm donor can't turn around 10 years later and say, hey, you know, I wonder how that kid's doing. I'd really like to meet my offspring and have a relationship with my offspring that I sired through this anonymous sperm donor so long ago. You know, no one would participate in either making a donation to a sperm bank nor making a withdrawal from a sperm bank if the state did not provide that wall of anonymity between the parents to do that. So I think for people to say, oh, I'm entitled to have a baby just because I want to have a baby, that's not, in fact, legally the case. What is legally the case is that the state has created artificially the conditions that allow it to be possible for strangers to be parents at the same time and to completely cut the father out of the child's life. And I think the deep question that is raised by these kinds of issues is simply this: is it in anybody's interest? Is it in the interest of society? Is any social good being served by the state creating this artificial barrier between parents? And I would argue that there is really no public interest to be served. It's obvious what the woman's private interest is. I want a baby, and I want what I want. But we don't just give people what they want just because they want it. You know, that by itself is not a sufficient reason to say that the state will help you in creating a lifetime of fatherlessness for another human being. I don't see why we should say that any social good is served by doing that.
It's really, truly ironic that a woman who comes to a fertility to a sperm bank and says, I want me a baby, can only do that and say, and I can do this all by myself, and I ought to be able to do this all by myself, and this child will be my sole pet project, only does that by a law that by its very nature recognizes that that's not how kids come about.
Exactly. That's exactly right. You have to somehow cut the father out of the loop in order for that to be possible. And, you know, a moment's thought will tell you why that's the case. I mean, I'm sure every person listening to this program is aware of cases where a woman has said, gee, I want to have a baby by myself, and she has some kind of liaison with some guy she knows, gets herself pregnant, has the baby, and then down the line there are complications because either she wants something from the man that he doesn't want to provide, or the man wants something from her that she doesn't, you know, some involvement with the child that she doesn't want, or the father's parents, the paternal grandparents want to have a relationship with the child. All kinds of complications come about when you actually know the father of the child, you know. So doing it anonymously, you know, if you're going to do it and really have it be your project, you really have to have it be anonymous. And the fact is that that's not really in anybody's interest. In the end, it's not in anybody's interest. It excuses us. It's a way of women excusing themselves from the difficult work of sustaining a relationship with their child's father. And it seems to me that one of the great gifts that children need from their parents is to see that their parents love one another and love them and can cooperate and work together in the rearing of those children, that this is one of the great things that parents can do and should be doing for their kids, and that it's really a great loss when they don't have that in their lives.
Jennifer Roback Morse is our guest. We're talking about the right to have a child. She's a research fellow for the Hoover Institute, author of the book Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World, and she's also written an article for the latest edition of Touchstone Magazine titled First Comes Marriage. Jennifer, it's one thing for, we're talking here, you know, someone might misunderstand this, that we're somehow discussing in a broad sense single motherhood. It's one thing to be left a single mother by divorce or death or something like that.
That's right. This is
an entirely different thing.
That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, and I think that using the term single mother obscures the very important differences, both legal differences and moral differences. And differences in levels of responsibility that the person has assumed in the various cases that we could name. When a woman goes to a sperm bank and makes a plan to have a baby through an anonymous sperm donor, she is making a plan in advance that her child shall be without a relationship with its father for a lifetime. She is planning that. That's not something that happened by accident or by some kind of misfortune. Everybody can understand those misfortunes. Everybody can understand that our plans don't always turn out the way we expect. But to make that kind of a plan, to have a radically fatherless child, seems to me is not something that we ought to support. And there was, in fact, in Indiana, a law was put forward and quickly shot down. But a law was put forward to say that sperm banks should really be only for married couples. And boy, it got shot down right and left, you know. But I think that law was on the right track, and I you know, really hope that people can defend that position. I was kind of sorry to see it happen, because the person obviously had good instincts who put it forward, but then wasn't prepared fully to defend their position once it started taking some attacks. And you know, really, that's one of the things I try to help people do, is to articulate why they think what they think. Because, you know, Todd, in these culture wars that we are in, if you can't say what you think and why, you're going to be rolled over eventually. You will eventually be worn down by the opposition. It's not good enough to just intuitively say, yuck, I don't like that, I resist that. You have to know why. You have to be ready to explain yourself, and that's part of what I try to do in my writings.
Okay, I'm trying to understand to stand on the other side of this issue and understand the woman who says, and tell me if I'm kind of thinking it through correctly from your perspective. The woman says, I want motherhood, but not marriage. I want the relationship with the child, but I don't need the relationship with the father or the husband. I want marriage and parenthood separate from one another. Is that essential? I mean, trying to put the best construction on it, is that essentially the if it were laid out in a careful form, what it is the woman wants when she comes to a sperm bank for a child?
Yes, that is what she's saying. And it can be, it might be that the woman is a radical lesbian separatist like these ladies in Vista, California, who had, you know, who didn't consciously wanted nothing to do with a man. Or it could be that she's 35 years old and doesn't have a husband and has no prospect of a husband and is getting desperate. But in either case, that's what is happening, is that we're separating marriage from procreation. And we're saying that motherhood is possible to have motherhood without a spousal relationship with anybody. And I think we've gone way far down this path in this society. And I think that one of the things we now can see is that the cost of doing that is the cost to the child, that the child is deprived of a relationship with their father. And all that that means, and we've talked on this program before about the importance of fathers in children's lives and all that they miss out on by not having their fathers, all of the difficulties that they have, all of the just how much worse a child's life chances are if they are deprived of a relationship with their father. To just kind of throw up our hands and say, well, just let people do whatever they want, it doesn't make any difference, well, that's simply not true. It makes a huge difference. And I think it makes a huge difference what kind of legal institutions we create, and it makes a huge difference what kinds of arguments we're willing to accept as being good enough reasons, and what kind of arguments we're willing to put back at people in response to their efforts to do these kinds of things. You know, it's not that we're saying you're a bad person, but we're just saying that just because you want it is not sufficient reason for you to do it, and is not sufficient reason for the law to support you in doing it. The fact that you want it isn't, in fact, a reason at all when it comes right down to it. You know, that I want to is not really an explanation or a justification for doing anything.
What worries me a little bit, Jennifer, and it might be a bit far-fetched, I don't know if it is. I mean, this days of legal things that make your eyes go wide, you know, in the eyes of the law, a corporation is an individual.
Yep.
And if individual rights, if the right to a child attaches to individuals, I can see some bright lawyer or law professor saying, look, corporation, individual. The law shouldn't care about the difference between the two. If the if Microsoft wants to have a baby, maybe Microsoft should have a baby. I mean, adopt a baby.
I haven't, I haven't thought through whether there's a demand for that yet. if there's a demand for it, but you know, the point is, if there's a demand for it, we're not really in much of a position to say no to it.
Not with individual rights.
That's right.
Now,
that's right.
The other thing I was thinking about, and would you stick with this on the other side of the break for a few minutes?
For a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, okay, just a few minutes. How far would we be from something like a pre-coital contract where the two get together and procreate naturally, the normal way, but there's an agreement beforehand, we will be strangers to one another, and you have no responsibility for this child, and I won't come after you, and you can't come seeking the child. What's the difference between that and the arrangement made for sperm donation?
That's a very interesting question, whether a contract like that would be honored, okay? And I think, in general, a lot of people think that they have a tacit contract of that sort, you know, where the woman says, oh, I want to have a baby, but don't worry, honey, I won't sue you for child support, and then, you know, 2 years later, she's there for child support. I don't think such a contract right now would be considered enforceable. I could be mistaken about that in some jurisdictions, but I don't know that that would be enforceable if you said we're going to make a plan to, you know. Although I should be careful in saying that, because in a certain way, egg donor and sperm donor contracts have that sense to them. And surrogates, there are aspects of surrogate mother contracts that have that, you know, that have that that kind of feature, you know, that you agree to carry a child for another couple, and you surrender certain rights in doing that. And some of those contracts are enforceable. And the law has gone, you know, for a while it was kind of tapping around with a white cane trying to figure out where to go next with some of this stuff. But the other area that where things are getting a little peculiar is really in the area of same-sex couples having children. The whole area of parentage is becoming very fuzzy, and it's becoming fuzzy because certain people want it to become fuzzy. And I think that's the, you know, kind of the interesting and alarming thing about this is that there have been a number of cases, relatively high-profile cases, of lesbian couples who break up and then have custody disputes over the child afterward. Now, what's interesting about that is that these cases become high profile when one of the gay activist groups becomes involved, whether it's Lambda Legal Defense or the Human Rights Campaign. Those kinds of groups become involved in defending one side or the other's claims against the other person. And there, like I said, there have been a number of these cases. In most cases, the biological mother of the child is trying to get away from her former lesbian partner and wants to not permit shared custody or visitation or those kinds of things. She wants to cut off the relationship between herself and her child with her former lesbian lover. And quite often, in fact, almost every case that I'm aware of, the Human Rights Campaign and the Lambda Legal Defense Fund have come to the defense of the non-biological, so-called social mother of the lesbian couple to say, oh, this woman has a bond with the child, she's entitled to visitation, and so on and so forth. And so that is opening up a whole new can of worms about what constitutes parentage. And in one case in Washington State, I'm telling you, the judge just read these people the Riot Act, but he was the dissenting judge, and the case went through with kind of a new set of standards being created for what counts as a legal parent.
I want to talk about that on the other side of the break. Jennifer Roback Morse is our guest. We're talking about the right to have a child. She is author of the book Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. You can purchase this book by calling Spence Publishing toll-free, 1-888-SPENPUB, S-P-E-N-P-U-B, 1-888-SPENPUB, or you can find out more about Smart Sex at www.spencepublishing.com. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. Listening to Issues, Etc.
People think of C.S. Lewis as the author of the Chronicles of Narnia, or the author of Mere Christianity, or Surprised by Joy, or any of his other books. But C.S. Lewis was an educator. What did C.S. Lewis, perhaps the most influential Christian apologist in the 20th century, have to say about his chosen vocation? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for January is called Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education. For more information about Irrigating Deserts, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the book on the homepage. Or you can order Irrigating Deserts for $22.99 from Concordia Publishing House. Call them toll-free, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues, Etc. book of the month for January, Irrigating Deserts.
Scores of people attend a series of evangelical gatherings held each year during this time in India. This Global Minute lets you hear it's one way to share Christ with the large numbers of men, women, and children who have no idea who Jesus is. Local churches worked with India Evangelical Mission during January on outreach crusades. But away from the big crowds, IEM missionaries and evangelists work quietly in different states operating reading rooms. These are centers where local Hindus or Muslims can stop in and browse through Bibles and other Christian literature. Bible studies have started out of the reading rooms, and they've even formed into worshiping groups of Christians who have started a church. Pray for Christ to break through the deep needs in India. Focus your prayers on India with a free brochure called To India with Love. Call 1-800-268-0461. 800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. In the Meyer family, we are all watching how daughter Katie deals with one of her Christmas gifts. Her fiancé Charlie is a great guy, but must have a sadistic streak in him. Or maybe the gift is masochistic, since they are going to get married next September. Whichever, Charlie gave Katie a rabbit. This is not Katie's first rabbit. It's her third, following in the big footprints of Corey and Amos. They were white males, but this bunny is brown. And although it's a female, Katie has named it Sam. Samantha? Although Corey and Amos belonged to Katie, Mom, I can't have a rabbit at school, and so Diane ended up taking care of the little fuzzballs. Not this time. You're on your own, kid. It's all yours. So, Katie, to help you fulfill your maternal duties, Mom and I want to share a paper you wrote when you were in the fifth grade. How to Clean Your Rabbit's Litter Box by Katie Meyer. To clean your rabbit's litter box, you must first get it. Do not breathe in. Carefully take it outside. Dump it somewhere in the yard. Now take the hose and hose it out. Now put fresh litter in. You can breathe now. Doesn't it give you hope to know that someday the kids will understand what you went through raising them? I'm Dale Meyer.
How would you like to see Caesarea, Gethsemane, Bethany, and the Jordan River? President James Kalthoff of the Missouri District of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, will host a tour of the Holy Land titled In the Master's Steps. An informational meeting will be presented Sunday, January 22nd at St. Paul's Lutheran Church de Pere, beginning at 3 p.m. For more information, contact the Missouri District of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. In the Master's Steps, hosted by President Kalthoff.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. For the next few minutes, Jennifer Roback Morse is still with us. We're talking about the right to have a child. Then we're going to be talking with Susan Muscat, National Right to Life Congressional Liaison in Washington, about national pro-life legislation in 2006. What lies ahead? Jennifer, when we were going into the break, you were talking about estranged same-sex couples who, having adopted children or had children by, you know, some other means, were now fighting in the courts for joint custody or visitation rights, and you mentioned a judge setting some new standards for what it meant to be a parent.
Well, the case I was talking about was that the judges who ruled in the case, they ultimately said that this person could be a de facto parent. This person had a de facto relationship, parental relationship with a child, and so therefore was entitled to some parental rights. That was quite separate from the Uniform Parentage Act, which has some very specific means of assigning parenthood. And the dissenting judge in that case said, you know, look, there are five different ways a person can establish maternity, and this person doesn't meet any of them. We have a perfectly fit parent here who's deciding she doesn't want her child to see this person. It's unprecedented to say that a fit parent can be told by the courts what to do with their own child, and that's what is happening. And he further made the point that a same-sex couple can, if they choose, use the existing means to attach themselves to a child. For instance, in this particular case, they could have done second-party adoption. In other words, the partner had the option all through the relationship And all through the life of this child, the first 4 or 5 years of the child's life, she could have done a second-party adoption, and they chose not to do that. And in his mind, this said, you know, look, they had their reasons for doing it or not doing it. They had the opportunity to do to make a legal claim that they're now claiming. We should not be creating an opportunity for the courts to directly intervene and examine the details of people's private lives when we have in front of us all the equipment that we need to determine whether this person is really, quote, a parent to a child that is not their biological offspring. And that's, I think, the issue that needs to be alarming to everybody, is that the move towards both same-sex marriage and same-sex parenting is creating a situation where the courts, the family courts, will have to be involved in assigning parental rights and in looking into the details of a family's life to say, yep, you're close enough, you count as a parent. Nope, you're not close enough, you don't count as a parent. And those kinds of things, already, Todd, in my opinion, the family courts are already the most intrusive courts in this country. To give them further powers of that sort, I think is just something everybody should be concerned about.
Well, okay, that gets me thinking here, because the kind of criteria that you would have to apply to that sort of a situation to say, yes, the non-biological quote-unquote parent here in this estranged same-sex relationship, those criteria would have to, they have to be entirely subjective.
Yes.
I mean,
that's right.
Paternity is objective. You can prove or disprove paternity, but you can't, how do you prove or disprove a bond?
Right. That's right. That's exactly right. And you know, even within that realm, there have been extraordinary cases which take account of extraordinary situations, such as grandparents that have been raising children for a long time and so on and so forth. You know, so there, the courts have tools to deal with extraordinary cases. What's happening here is that they're trying to fold the extraordinary case into the ordinary, you know, and to make this more routine. And, of course, as we know, the whole thrust of same-sex marriage has been to make same-sex relationships more normative, more acceptable, more routine. But the things that you have to do to make that kind of relationship work routinely are things that are really quite different from what a heterosexual couple needs. I mean, as I said at the beginning of the program, men and women can make babies very easily without any help from anybody. They do it all the time. And, in fact, regulating that and dealing with that and channeling that is the main social problem that most societies have to face. With same-sex couples, you're dealing with something quite different. The same-sex couple cannot produce a baby by themselves. They can only have a baby if somebody gives them one. And the way you're going to give them one is you're going to assign it to them. You're going to have the courts or somebody assigning a baby to a couple that didn't create it, and couldn't create it themselves. And the fact that we have infertile heterosexual couples who sometimes do adoption doesn't take away from the fact that that's an exceptional case, and nobody denies that that's an exceptional case. The birth mother and the birth father have rights that come from the fact that they are the natural parents of the child. The adoptive parents don't just drop in out of nowhere, you know, and the rights are not just terminated for no reason. That there's still the respect and honoring of the natural procreative capacity of that couple, and that is gradually and necessarily being undermined by the thrust towards same-sex marriage and same-sex parenting, and that's something that I think people need to be concerned about, because that does affect straight couples. If the law starts to say parents are whatever we say they are, you know, then we're all at risk.
One quick final question with less than a minute before we have to go, Jennifer. The upshot of this thing seems that children are becoming more and more property.
You bet. I agree, and I think that is really deplorable. I mean, people are seeing children as commodities, as if they're, you know, this is something I need to make my life complete, and I'm entitled to have it if I want it. And it's really quite a different perspective on what it means to be a parent and on what the relationship between the parent and the child needs to be. Thank goodness most people, when they actually get a child one way or the other, have that relationship more or less revealed to them by being in the relationship. The children straighten them out, you know, so to speak. You get over the idea that you get to pick the child you want and have the child the way you want it. And all of these other hyper-control things that we have in our consumer society, usually parenthood has a way of wiping that out. But what's happening to us is that in our society we're starting to view it at the social and institutional level as if children are entitlements or commodities. And that really is something that we need to move away from.
Check out Jennifer Roback-Morse's new website tonight, jennifer-roback-morse.com. Jennifer Roback-Morse with hyphens in between .com. It's her new website. Check it out when you get home tonight. Jennifer Roback-Morse, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks so much, Todd.
Jennifer is a research fellow for the Hoover Institute. She's author of the book Smart Sex, Finding Lifelong Love in a Hookup World. And she's also written an article in the latest Touchstone magazine titled First Comes Marriage. Earlier today, we had the opportunity to talk with Susan Musket. She's Congressional Liaison for National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C. We were curious, after talking yesterday, about Missouri 2006 pro-life legislation and Illinois pro-life legislation for 2006, such as it is. What would be going on nationally in 2006? My first question for her had to do with how much it would matter for pro-life legislation in 2006 that this year is an election year with one-third of the Senate being reelected and all of the House being reelected.
Well, I think what happens when it's an election year is that the members in Congress tend to look very closely at the votes they're casting because they know that them being so close to their election, that the electorate might be watching them much closer. So I think that it might have an impact in trying to get some of the members to really think hard and long about the votes they cast.
What do we know about the mind of the American electorate when it comes to the basic issues that involve pro-life legislation?
We know that poll after poll has shown that a majority of Americans want to see abortion be restricted to a very limited number of abortions, abortions in the case of the life of the mother, rape, or incest. We've seen poll after poll that reflects that. The other thing that we're seeing through polls is that it's today's young people who are becoming more and more pro-life.
Okay, let's talk about the docket then. What are some pieces of pro-life legislation that we can expect at least to see, if not to see passed, in 2006?
We expect to have votes on a ban on human cloning. You know, you've probably been following in the media the Korean cloning scandal. And that involves the Korean scientist, Dr. Hwang, who announced in 2005 that he had derived 11 patient-specific embryonic stem cell lines from cloned embryos. And this was promoted in the media as a scientific breakthrough with much fanfare and hoopla in the media. Well, it comes to turn out that an investigation by Dr. Hwang's university has found that he, in fact, did not create any of the 11 stem cell lines. And we find out that, contrary to his assertions, that all the women's eggs that he used were voluntarily donated. In fact, 20 women were paid $1,400 each for their eggs, and two of his junior scientists had to donate their eggs. So what it comes down to is if Dr. Hwang's team has never been able to clone an embryo, then that means that after 7 years and scientists working around the world on this, no one has been able to get research cloning to work on a practical scale. And so I think that this should have an impact on members, that they should start to realize that it's important that we channel our limited scientific resources towards the research that works, and that is the adult stem cell and umbilical cord blood research.
Well, and some might say, on the other hand, Susan, that, look, the problem is we need more research dollars and we need that federal funding to that we won't need the spigot open on that federal funding so that we can pursue this promise, they say, of human cloning.
Well, I think, though, the point is that this research has been going on, and if you talk to a lot of the scientists, they will admit that one of the problems with human cloning is the large number of women's eggs that it requires. Cloning research is dependent on the exploitation of women for their eggs. Just this week, another allegation against Dr. Hwang's team is that they actually used more than 1,600 women's eggs in his two studies, and that's close to four times the number of women's eggs that he had asserted that he had used. Now, if this allegation is true, then that, again, is a reflection on the fact that, you know, that was another thing that they appraised him on, is that he had reduced the number of women's eggs needed for his research. And, again, we're finding that this may not be true. And some 30 women's rights groups, including the Korean Women's Associations, have demanded an investigation into this.
Who, in both the House and the Senate, would be an obstacle to a favorable vote that would ban all human cloning at the national level?
Well, you know, in the House, we have passed it repeatedly by large margins. Last time was in 2003 by 241 votes. But we did have 155 members who voted against the human cloning ban, which is really disappointing. In the Senate, we've never had a vote, and so we are working to try to get as many senators as possible on board in support of this. I know that Senator Jim Talent is a co-sponsor of the True Human Cloning Ban, the Brownback-Landrieu Bill, S-658, and we would like to see Senator Bond become a co-sponsor, and hopefully, you know, someday he may become one. But we, again, so really it comes down to, in the Senate, we are working to try to get as many senators on board on this bill as possible.
What do you make of the position of Senator Orrin Hatch, who has the reputation of being pro-life popularly, but on the position of human cloning is all wrong?
Yeah, it's a real disappointment because, you know, he takes the position that you know, it's not implanted in the woman. The human embryo is not, cloned embryo is not implanted in the woman. And so until it's implanted in the woman, he feels that it's, you know, you're free to go ahead and experiment on this cloned human embryo. And, you know, that position doesn't really hold water because it's just a matter of time before scientists are able to create artificial wombs in which they will grow these embryos longer and longer and be able to experiment on them. And so, you know, that argument just does not hold water. The truth of the matter is that, you know, a cloned embryo, even before it is implanted in the woman's womb, it's a human being. And it should not be created and experimented on and killed just for experimental purposes.
Is there any abortion restriction legislation that we can look forward to in 2006?
Yes. We are hoping to have a vote in the Senate on legislation to prohibit individuals from transporting a minor girl out of state for an abortion in circumvention of a home state parental involvement law. I know that this is a problem that you have there in Missouri where your minor girls are taken across state lines to Illinois for abortions. And so if we could enact legislation like this, I think it would be very helpful to states such as yours. We had similar legislation passed in the House last April. It's called the Child Interstate Abortion Notification Act. And we'd like to see similar legislation taken up in the Senate this year.
What about on the issues of euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide?
I think that is an issue at this point in time that is mainly being fought out at the state level. And so I don't expect to see anything at the federal level on that.
What do you think about this, Susan? We have the nomination hearings of Samuel Alito coming up pretty soon here in the beginning part of the year. And if he is confirmed by the Senate, do you think that that would harden the resistance of some lawmakers against pro-life legislation, knowing that the court is taking a very small but incremental step away from Roe or perhaps toward reconsidering Roe?
I don't think so. I think that what really influences these lawmakers, to be honest with you, for the most part, is what they hear from their constituents. I think very much they're influenced by the calls, the letters, what they hear at town hall meetings when they go back to the state. I think that has more of an influence because, let's face it, they all want to be reelected, and they know it's the voters who reelect them. And so I can never emphasize enough to grassroots citizens how their calls, letters, emails, faxes really add up to have an impact on how a member votes.
Can you give us a breakdown of both House and Senate when it comes to the issues of pro-life? What are we talking about in terms of numbers or percentages there?
Well, for instance, on this law that I was talking about to prohibit a child being taken out of state for an abortion, that passed the House of Representatives by some 270 votes. So on that instance, we had some 270 members who were voting pro-life. In the Senate, they have not voted on this per se, and so, you know, it'll be interesting to see how many we could get on this. But, of course, you know, in the Senate, we have a hardcore of members, probably about 30, who you would probably never get to have vote on a pro-life piece of legislation.
We're talking about national pro-life legislation in 2006. Susan Muscat is our guest. She's Congressional Liaison for National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C. Well, the Senate obviously is a harder nut to crack there, because, and also the majority is slimmer, but there's by no means a guarantee that a Republican majority means a pro-life majority in the Senate. Am I right?
That is correct. We have a number of Republican senators who do not vote pro-life. The two main senators, Senator Collins and Senator Snow, Senator Chafee oftentimes does not. Senator Jeffords, I meant to say, of Vermont, never votes pro-life. So, yes, we have a number, well, now he's an independent. But anyway, the bottom line is, yes, we have a number of Republicans who do not vote pro-life.
And pro-life Democrats, we interview representatives of Democrats for Life on this program on a regular basis, but pro-life Democrats that people might not be aware of in both the House and the Senate.
Yes. In fact, it is due to the pro-life Democrats in the House that oftentimes we are able to win on very close votes. We have probably about 35 or so pro-life Democrats in the House that, you know, consistently vote with us on pro-life legislation. And so when it is a close vote, oftentimes it is due to their help that we're able to win.
Do you see more pro-life Democrats being elected to the House and the Senate in the future?
You know, I would like to see that happen, but, you know, I guess only time would tell.
And what really needs to change since, come back to where we began, since 2006 is an election year for the entire Congress and one-third of the Senate, what needs to change there to see an easier path for pro-life legislation in the years beyond this year's election?
What would be the most helpful is if we could see a change in the U.S. Senate to have more pro-life senators enacted, because what happens is that if they filibuster a pro-life piece of legislation, then it ratchets up the number of votes we need from just a majority of 51 to that we need 60 votes to vote with us on pro-life legislation. And so that is even a supermajority that we have to try to win over. And so that is the key, is that we would need more pro-life senators elected to the U.S. Senate.
Two final questions. Since there will be a hearing for this nominated Supreme Court, and he is being put forth, by all accounts, as pro-life in his thinking, do the confirmation hearings in the Senate really kind of, even though it's not legislation, it is an official vote, do they kind of figure as one of the biggest pro-life votes the Senate's going to make this year?
Well, we would like to see an up or down vote on Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. And, you know, we are hopeful, for instance, that tomorrow the U.S. Supreme Court, if not tomorrow, then Monday, they are supposed to conference on whether to take up an appeal of the Federal Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. And we are hopeful that the U.S. Supreme Court will decide to take up this appeal, because we would like to see the Supreme Court reverse its earlier position and to, in fact, allow the Congress to enact a ban on partial birth abortions. So we are waiting to hear tomorrow or possibly Monday what the Supreme Court's decision is on that. And so if Mr. Alito was to be confirmed, then he would probably be on the Supreme Court when that case comes before the court for their decision.
And then finally, on the executive side, do you wish that President George W. Bush would be more vocal, come out and do a little bit more running of the plays when it comes to pro-life legislation?
Well, he's been doing a great job. You know, he has been very outspoken in terms of saying that he wants to see a total ban on human cloning enacted into law. And as you probably remember, he had the press conference at his at the White House in which he had the snowflake babies. These are babies who were the result of the adoption of so-called spare embryos left over from in vitro fertilization. But as pro-lifers, I think everybody always feels that we could have more of a bully pulpit in terms of talking about the pro-life point of view, whether it's a member of Congress, whether it's a president, whether it's just everyday citizens. I think we always are hoping to hear it because we know that the more it's talked about, the more that we change the hearts and minds of the American people.
NRLC.org is the website for National Right to Life based in Washington, D.C., NRLC.org. Susan Muscat is their congressional liaison. Susan, thank you for being our guest.
My pleasure.
All right, that's our conversation with Susan Muscat. It's nice to get a picture of what's going to happen in 2006. It's nice to have a little bit of a look ahead. I'm wondering what those elections are going to mean, because in the last big election we had, 2004 presidential and congressional elections, it was pretty obvious that voters were voting with their values. And that the issue of abortion, while it wasn't the top issue, certainly was among the top issues. So will pro-life legislation, or actually will pro-life issues, be a big question when we go to the polls in 2006? Well, Issues Etc. is obviously committed to keeping you informed on pro-life issues in 2006 and defending life from beginning to end. Yesterday we talked with representatives of Missouri Right to Life and Illinois Right to Life about those two states and the prospects for legislation there in our listening area, and today with National Right to Life about the national picture of pro-life legislation in 2006. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Dr. James Lamb, picking up on this very subject. The church on Sunday celebrated the circumcision of Jesus. Does that have anything to do with life issues? Well, Dr. James Lamb says, yes, it does. And we'll talk about it on the other side of this break. Then a little later in the program, Dr. Thomas Madden, we check in with him while he's traveling to see what he thinks of the whole claim made by a primetime news special that aired over the holidays, Pope Joan, a female pope. See what Dr. Thomas Madden from St. Louis University thinks about that. Then we'll talk about Epiphany with Dr. Richard Stuckwish and the curses made by charismatic extremists with our good friend Bob Lico in the last half hour of the program.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.